South Korea's president declares, then cancels, martial law.
I mean, essentially what we have here is the president declaring martial law because of attacks on his wife and sort of budget paralysis in the National Assembly.
President Joe Biden is in Angola.
This is Joe Biden's first trip to the African continent as president, and also his last.
And a new device to help Ukrainians stay warm this winter.
Rinat says it is a more environmentally friendly solution than a gas-powered generator, but it is more expensive.
Today is Wednesday, December 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. It's been a wild ride in South Korea. President Yoon Suk-yeol shocked the world by declaring martial law on Tuesday night, citing the need to eradicate what he calls anti-state forces and to protect the constitutional democratic order. Reaction from political opposition was swift, saying Yoon overstepped his authority. Chaotic protests sprang up as people, as well as other elected officials, tried to figure out exactly what was happening and why. Eventually, President Yoon rescinded the martial law order, but many questions remain. To hopefully answer some of them, I'm joined by VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
Well, essentially, in a early morning, not even late night speech, Yoon backed down from his earlier decree of martial law. He basically said martial law troops have withdrawn and the formal decree will be lifted as soon as cabinet members can actually get together and formally lift that decree. Now, the Yonhap news agency has actually already said that has happened. So apparently, you know, the real drama as far as the martial law developments are concerned is actually over. I think the bigger question now is, what are the political ramifications of this? This seems like a real unforced error, and there are real questions about whether President Yoon Suk-yeol, who was already very unpopular, can survive this.
So let's get to that. What are the political forces? What were the issues that brought this about in the first place?
It's a bit confusing, to be honest. There's not a single analyst that you will find anywhere who thought that this was likely to happen. There have been rumors for months that Yoon was considering this, but these were very, very fringy rumors, mainly put forward by the South Korean opposition, Yoon's opponents, who said he was trying to do this and he was planning to do this. Yoon had always firmly denied it. Now, as for why, well, that's a tough question. In his speech tonight, he referred to anti-state forces, North Korean sympathizers, but some of the more concrete things he mentioned were budget disputes, attacks on his he referenced sort of indirectly attacks on his allies. South Korea's opposition forces have for many, many months attacked Yoon Suk-yeol's wife, Kim Kon-hee, for corruption allegations. She is alleged to have accepted gifts inappropriately and also been involved in sort of some influence peddling incidents. He has very vociferously pushed against all of these accusations and, in fact, accused his critics of being anti-state North Korea sympathizers. Of course, there are people on the South Korean left who do advocate for closer relations with North Korea. However, it is overly simplistic to call them North Korea sympathizers, I would think. So there's no one anywhere, despite the longtime frictions in South Korea over these and other issues. No one thought this was going to happen. And now what happens sort of is the bigger question.
Now, South Korea is considered a healthy democracy. To declare martial law in a healthy democracy over nonviolent political concerns does seem extraordinary. What has the South Korean public's reaction been?
I mean, essentially what we have here is the president declaring martial law because of attacks on his wife and sort of budget paralysis in the National Assembly, which, as you mentioned, is probably not going to be viewed very positively by many members of the public or human rights activists and the like. In fact, you are seeing some statements, quite honestly, of concern coming from Washington, D.C. tonight. Deputy Secretary of State Kurt Campbell said he was watching with grave concern. There was a Deputy State Department spokesperson who also said something along the lines of, look, we want this to be resolved peacefully. And the vote we saw in Parliament tonight was consistent with this being resolved peacefully. Essentially, in so many words, not speaking so positively of what Yoon has done tonight. However, I expect there to be lots of protests. That's sort of what we expect to see this coming week. I mean, there are still protesters out there in the streets now. I think that since Yoon has lifted the martial law decree, you will see perhaps some of the more intense protests immediately sort of melt away. But you're already seeing South Korean civil society and activist groups call for major protests in the coming weeks. I expect to see some really, really big gatherings, sort of reminiscent of what we saw when the previous South Korean president Park Geun-hye, the previous conservative South Korean president Park Geun-hye, was under a similar type of controversy that eventually led to her impeachment and removal from office.
VOA's Bill Gallo is in Seoul. Bill, I know it's a busy, crazy night there for you. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Anytime. Thanks.
Just as President Joe Biden is wrapping up his time as president, he is marking the beginning of a new relationship between the U.S. and the African continent. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Luanda, Angola, where Biden is making a historic visit.
This is Joe Biden's first trip to the African continent as president, and also his last. After a short stop in the tiny island nation of Cabo Verde, he landed in Angola late Monday for a two-day trip with a packed agenda, as he told President João Lourenço when they met at Luanda's pink-hued presidential palace.
Very proud to be the first American president to visit Angola. And I'm deeply proud of everything we have done together to transform our partnership thus far. There's so much ahead of us, so much we can do.
His administration's top Africa advisor told VOA that Biden sees Angola as Exhibit A of a collaborative relationship with Washington. Francis Brown is Senior Director for African Affairs at the National Security Council.
We, the United States, are working with Angola on a few really important things. One is bolstering peace and security in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Another is growing economic opportunities in the region. A third is technological and scientific cooperation.
Biden also toured the nation's slavery museum, where he acknowledged the deep blood ties between Angola and the United States, and he painted an optimistic picture of the future.
Although I don't know exactly what the future will hold, I know the future runs through Angola, through Africa. I mean it sincerely. I'm not kidding.
Human rights horrors are far from a thing of the past, rights groups say. Kate Hickson is Advocacy Director for Africa at Amnesty International USA.
Amnesty has repeatedly documented excessive and lethal force to disrupt peaceful demonstrations. Not only is lethal force used in these demonstrations, but the victims' families do not have recourse to access to justice. We've also seen several repressive laws passed since 2020. Since 2020, it's been illegal to criticize the president. More recently, this year, we've seen two laws approved that further threaten the rights to freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and the media.
Brown told VOA that the president always raises these concerns privately.
He never shies away from talking about democracy and human rights issue with counterparts. And I think that's pretty consistent with the way he's been throughout his long career in public service.
Biden wraps his visit Wednesday with a trip to the port city of Lobito, where a new U.S.-financed rail line brings raw materials from Africa's interior to this bustling port. Anita Powell, VOA News, Luanda.
And turning now to the Middle East, the success of Syrian rebels against Damascus forces in the latest few days is offering Turkey an opportunity to secure strategic goals in Syria. Dorian Jones has that report from Istanbul.
The lightning offensive by Syrian rebel forces of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and the Syrian National Army could open the door for Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to establish a dialogue he has wanted with his Syrian counterpart, Bashar al-Assad. Until now, Assad has rejected Erdogan's overtures. But analysts say Ankara's influence over the two Syrian rebel forces fighting Damascus gives the Turkish leader new leverage. Murat Aslan is with the SETA Foundation for Political, Economic and Social Research, a Turkish pro-government think tank.
To find a solution, Turkey can easily stop both entities and start a process. Turkey does have this strength, and Assad is well aware of it. So the Turkish intention politically is not to escalate in Syria and start a political, diplomatic engagement with Assad regime.
Analysts say Erdogan is looking for engagement with Assad to return many of the 4 million Syrian refugees in Turkey, as Turkish public unease over their presence grows. Aydın Selcan is a former senior Turkish diplomat who served in the region and is now a foreign policy analyst for Turkey's MediaScope news portal.
According to the opinion polls here, yes, the Syrian refugees or the refugee question in general, including the Afghans and others, is a question, is an issue for Turkish people, for any government. It would be a wonderful win to see these Syrians going back to Syria on their own will.
The Syrian rebels are also helping to secure another key goal of Ankara, making territorial gains against the US-backed forces of the YPG. Ankara accuses the YPG of having ties to the PKK, which is fighting the Turkish state. However, analysts say Turkey will not stand by if those successes are reversed. That's a warning from Murat Aslan of SETA.
Once the developments are out of control, like PKK, PYD, YPG, whatever the name is, expands to the other region and becomes an actor that can challenge all, then for sure Turkey will intervene.
While the successes of the Syrian rebels could advance Ankara's goals in Syria, analysts warn the rebels' links to radical Islamist groups could harm Turkey. Hüseyin Barca is a professor of international relations at Ankara's Middle East Technical University.
The crashing down of Bashar Assad regime is not in the interest of Turkey, because there will be chaos. Who is going to rule? What type of structure we are going to have there? Not Kurdish state, they are radicals. And another Daesh-style territory would be not in the interest of Turkey. In Turkish prisons, there are thousands of Daesh people.
And they say the Syrian rebels' successes are an opportunity for Ankara to secure vital security and diplomatic goals. But those successes also bring the risk of further instability on Turkey's border. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world.
The head of the United Nations Children Agency said Monday that children make up about half of all armed gang members in Haiti and called for their enhanced protection. UNICEF's executive director, Catherine Russell, told a UN meeting that the children are being used as informants, cooks, and sex slaves, and they're being forced to perpetrate violence themselves.
Filippo Toretta, a 22-year-old Italian man who confessed in court to killing his ex-girlfriend, was convicted of her murder on Tuesday and sentenced to life in prison in a case that fueled national outrage over violence against women. The victim, Giulia Cicchettin, had been stabbed more than 70 times, and her body was wrapped in plastic bags.
A court in Bangladesh has rescheduled a bail hearing for Krishna Das Prabhu, a prominent Hindu leader who was detained after leading large rallies in the Muslim-majority country demanding better security for minority groups. This comes as tensions spiked following reports of the desecration of the Indian flag across Bangladesh. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
I'm Alexis Strope. Looking now at American politics, as we've discussed here before, immigration is a very contentious issue in the U.S., and that contentiousness is on full display in liberal-leaning Los Angeles, where the city government openly disagrees with President-elect Donald Trump's plans for mass deportations and cracking down on migrants. In fact, Los Angeles has approved a so-called sanctuary city ordinance. It can't stop federal officials from deporting undocumented immigrants, but it reinforces the city's vow to protect its immigrant population. Angelina Bagdasarian has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Claudia Ventura has lived in Los Angeles for 20 years. She has a job and a family here, but no legal documentation. Ventura is among the roughly 800,000 LA residents who lack U.S. legal status. And like many others, she feels uneasy after Donald Trump won the presidential election.
Now, when I see not a lot of people in the street, it's less people, it's bad. Yeah, I think the people are scared for the deportation.
The Los Angeles City Council approved a so-called sanctuary city ordinance on November 19th. This means local police and state authorities are not going to share information on people's immigration status with federal immigration authorities unless it involves a serious crime. Human rights activists like Jorge Mario Cabrera from the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles, or CHURLA, support the ordinance.
A city ordinance like this sends a very strong message to the community in Los Angeles and to the rest of the nation that in Los Angeles, resources available will be used for the purposes of keeping the community safe, of keeping the community trusting in their own leaders, and in keeping the community thriving, not in arresting them or causing chaos in their communities.
Yet not everyone in the city agrees with this decision. Trump supporters, roughly 38% of residents, according to the election results, don't want LA to be a sanctuary city.
I think it's a disgrace. I think that we have to take care of our own first. When we say America first, it doesn't mean you don't take care of others. It just means we take care of our own first.
Linda Hanna's parents are from Mexico. They came into the United States legally, and she believes whoever has done so illegally should be deported. The ordinance will have little practical effect because LA has barred police or immigration officials from questioning a person about their immigration status since 1979. The LA's new status doesn't mean there can't be deportations. It just means that local authorities won't help federal officers find and deport undocumented immigrants. Immigration attorney Tatiana Edwards-Behar.
I think that federal officers will start with mass raids as opposed to asking random passersby for documents on the streets. I believe there will be mass raids at factories and in the agricultural industry where, according to official data, undocumented immigrants are most likely to work.
Cabrera believes amnesty is a better idea than deportations.
We have to insist that mass legalization is the option. We have to insist that there's a better way to treat immigrants in this country.
After the inauguration on January 20th, Trump has strongly suggested he might declare a national emergency and use U.S. military personnel to help conduct mass deportations, a move that immigration advocates have vowed to fight in court. For Angelina Magdasaran in Los Angeles, California, Hannah Rice, VOA News.
Winter is coming to Ukraine. The days and nights are getting colder, and soon much of the country will be covered in snow. All this as Russian attacks regularly target the country's energy infrastructure, power plants, transmission lines, substations, and the like. Blackouts are a common occurrence, and for most Ukrainians, no electricity means no heat. VOA's Anna Chernikova is in Kyiv, and she brings us this look at some new technology that's meant to help keep people out of the cold.
This is the sound of gasoline-powered generators that Ukrainians across the country hear on the streets of their cities every day. This enables Ukrainian businesses to keep going when the country is living with the long hours of electricity outages caused by Russian shelling of Ukraine's energy infrastructure. This solution works for many Ukrainian businesses, as current electricity outages are 8 hours per day at least. However, this does not work for residents of apartment buildings, where such generators would be too loud, dirty, and dangerous. Instead, they suffer from the blackouts with no light, heating, or normal water supply at their homes. With Ukraine entering the third winter under Russian attacks on its energy sector, many Ukrainians found additional solutions that could be implemented both for businesses and homes. Renat Nigmatulin, whose company is installing such systems across the country, told VOA it is a hybrid storage inverter with an energy storage battery that charges the battery when there is electricity available. And then it can be stored energy in the battery for up to 8 hours during blackouts, all with no loud generator or exhaust fumes. Renat says it is a more environmentally friendly solution than a gas-powered generator, but it is more expensive. The price of such systems starts with $1,500. Ukrainians living in private houses have both options, depending on budget. However, for apartment buildings, the storage battery is the only solution, as the use of generators in apartments is forbidden due to safety reasons. President Volodymyr Zelensky, in his Tuesday address to the nation, once again emphasized that the situation in Ukraine's energy sector is tough. He said Ukraine had reached some new air defense agreements and expects more air defense capabilities to arrive in December and January. Zelensky mentioned that winter is the time when Russia will try to use the cold as a weapon against Ukrainians. Meanwhile, in the early hours of Tuesday, Russian forces conducted yet another shelling of the energy infrastructure across the country, hitting one of the energy facilities with a drone in the western city of Ternopil. Local authorities urged residents to charge their devices and to stock up on drinking water, as there is a blackout in the city and region for an indefinite period. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Elections in Africa are often marked by high stakes and heightened tensions, which is decidedly unhealthy for voters. Experts in Ghana say campaign activities, voter fatigue, and fear of political tension and violence can be deadly. Sananu Tord reports from Accra, Ghana.
According to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data, ACLED, an independent NGO collecting data on violent conflicts and protests around the world, since 2000, nearly 50% of election-related violence globally has occurred in Africa, exposing citizens to significant health risk. Ghanaian Ministry of Health's National Ambulance Service Director of Operations, Foster Ansombrijan, says while violence is a concern, road crashes are the leading health hazard during elections.
Because of the parties moving around, campaigning, some deep into the night, and so the drivers become tired. And so we know driver fatigue also leads to crashes, road traffic crashes. So we've observed that anytime we are in an election, the number of crashes goes up.
According to the National Road Safety Authority, during election years, road crashes in Ghana spike by approximately 10%, as security resources are often redirected to crowd control and campaign security. Limited road law enforcement during these periods exacerbates the problem. Anson Brijan says another health concern is physical exhaustion and dehydration. Long hours at campaign events and standing in queues to vote can take a toll on citizens.
Some of them, they don't even eat because they want to go early and then go and cast their votes. So they don't eat. They will stay in the queue for a very longer time. And some become dehydrated. Some also becomes hypoglycemia sets in because they've not eaten. And so some may be faint. Some may even collapse.
Isaac Newman Arthur is a clinical psychologist and spokesperson for the Ghana Psychologist Association. He says beyond physical health, the stress and tension surrounding elections can severely impact mental well-being, especially for individuals with pre-existing conditions.
Depending on whatever happened during the political season, someone may never recover from the impact of whatever they went through, and that can be lifelong.
As Ghana gears up for elections on December 7, 2024, to elect the president and members of parliament, the National Ambulance Service is stepping up its preparedness to address these health risks. Its Emergency Medical Services Supervisor, Daniel Asari, says they are equipped with modern ambulances and trained personnel to help mitigate health hazards.
National Ambulance Service have been able to give basic first aid training to these institutions like the police service, fire service and immigration and prisons. So we did a training program for them so that they will be able to get certain basic first knowledge.
Authorities at Ghana's Ambulance Service say while elections mark a pivotal moment in democracy, they also bring health challenges, and their goal is to make exercising their democratic rights as safe as possible for all citizens. Sana Anutod, VOA Africa, Accra, Ghana.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.